All right, everybody, it is Monday here in the beautiful city of Chicago. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com. And, of course, this is Chicago Music Revealed. I am also the director of program and entertainment at the Epiphany Center for the Arts, 201 South Ashland Avenue, opening soon. Hopefully everything is opening soon. This one's in particular will be opening soon. We got three different performance venues. We are looking forward to hosting a lot of you for live performances, blues, jazz, rock, Latin, hip hop, house, everything in between. It is going to be incredible. As soon as all of us can get together and actually see each other in person, it will be even more incredible. So part of the show that I've been doing here, Chicago Music Reveal, we've been talking about connecting the entire music industry, obviously. If you watched my interview yesterday with Sam Newsom, it was great. He's from New York. We've been talking to different people throughout the entire country and also right here in Chicago. And there is actually our guest today, Barry Williams. He is kind of a little bit of both. He grew up in Chicago and in L.A., an incredibly accomplished musician, performed with so many people, I can't even start to listen. I'm going to Bear, and there he is. Bear, how are you? Oh, I'm doing great, and I apologize for the little delay I had here, but I'm glad we started. So it's I always say, you know, we started at 6:17, but this is a music show, so we're all improvising anyway. So, you know. When last time you went to a concert and a band started right at 8 o'clock? I can't remember. So, exactly. Well, so it's a pleasure having you on. And before we get into your whole career and everything, I mean, you've got a record label. You've performed with, I mean, the litany goes on and on. George Duke, Rita Baker, I mean, Frankie Beverly, Boney James, Mae Staples, just to name a few. So we will continue talking about all of this stuff because, I mean, we can go down a wormhole here for the 4 hours, but we won't do that. But, before we get started on everything, obviously, all of the gigs are canceled. We're not doing live performance-wise. Right. And what are you doing? How are you getting through this time?
Well, Mike, as I was thinking this morning as I got up and was showering and everything, we've all become broadcasters, whether we liked it or not.
That's
what we're doing. So I'm learning OBS, you know, the streaming program. I'm learning Facebook Live. I'm learning YouTube. I'm creating content. I'm, you know, in the studio, in the house, you know, creating content. But yeah, we've all become broadcasters, whether we wanted to or not. That's where we are now. And so, you know, it's a brand new frontier. And so I'm busy, swallowing as many tutorials as I can, you know, without my head exploding,
but that's right. That's right.
You know, trying fun with it, you know, cause it's who knew?
That's
true.
I
just talking about the pandemic, you know, everybody lost shows, you know, I mean, everybody lost a ton of stuff. Interestingly enough, I'm the musician with Frankie Beverly and Maze, and we were scheduled to start back from our normal hiatus in March 28th in Orlando, and then we were heading out on Tom Joyner cruise, of all things.
Oh, man.
Yeah. You know, with all of this coming on the pike, you know, a few weeks before that, you know, we're all like on needles and nervous as possibly be. We're like, is this actually still happening? We can't go on a cruise. We just, you know, we can't do that.
No.
So fortunately and unfortunately, it got, you know, pushed aside, canceled. And so that's where we are, you know, but I'm just at home, creating as much content and as possible, and learning new skills. You know,
with all of the stuff that's going on right now, you tell me, because perfect person to talk to because of everything you've done and the fact that you've got your record label. You're a studio musician for 25 years and everything else. But you know, I think the silver lining of this entire situation could possibly be is that a lot of musicians are going to figure out a different way to connect with their audience and just their music, literally just out of necessity. And then the ones that actually can figure things out and understand those little niches and how to turn, figure out how to do stuff. And then when they can start performing live, some musicians are going to really find out that they really connected with even a larger audience and might help in the long run. But, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
I agree with Mike. Yeah. you know, this is, again, this is a new frontier, and those of us that are brave enough to learn these new ways of doing this, you know, we will eventually, things will get back to a normalcy of some sort.
Yeah.
You know, but I think the difference, normal, you know, we'll have a little normalcy, but that stuff that we're learning now, I don't think that's ever going away.
Right.
So we kind of have to kind of come up with a nice, delicate balance of view. I think people are, I think musicians and artists, it's going to have to, you know, it's a paradigm shift that mm-hmm. we're all having to deal with, you know. But I believe you're, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, for somebody like you who's traveled all over the place, you know, I've talked to different musicians that tour nationally, internationally, and all that stuff. And I remember last week I talked to Bobby Broom, you know, a world renowned guitarist, and I asked him the same questions that I'll ask you. But I mean, have you ever been in a situation with all your travels, all of the different things you've done in your career, that's even close to being as similar as this one, where like everything is shut down? Because, you know, every once in a while there might be a plane delayed or a plane canceled or a gig canceled because of weather or something, but nobody can work at this point. And that, I mean, I can't even think of anything similar to this.
No, Mike, there's nothing. We've never, I've been in this professionally for 7 years. I'm dating myself here, but never did I look down the pike and see nothing.
Yeah.
it's so funny when this whole thing started and I'm listening to the news and I'm saying to myself, and they're starting to shut things down. And they started to shut down. I think it was actually the first thing I remember them talking about, was the new XFL.
Yep.
You know, which I love. I'm a football fan.
Yeah.
Crazy football. Go Bears. But when they pulled the basketball stuff off,
yeah,
when they did the season and, you know, those guys are test positive and stuff, I'm like, oh crap, there are a bunch of crowds there. What is live music about? It's the lifeblood of live music is crowds. I'm like, yeah. Oh man, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I've told a lot of people, and I'm sure you probably agree. I mean, even during the financial crisis in 2008, there was still business for us. There was a club open. Right. There was a venue. There was something happening.
Exactly.
There's something just so odd that it just stops. And it's like, who would have thought the entertainment business would have been this vulnerable to anything? I mean, it just, you know, it does compute, but this is something that I think we're all going to have to figure out how to maneuver around for a very long time, because it's not going away tomorrow. But, you know, to your point with the different thing you're doing and learning how to broadcast, and all of us are turning into broadcasters, I think the ones that take it seriously and learn the craft, it'll just enhance things once you start out of it, you know.
Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about your background. You grew up in Co. And, you know, looking over the bio that you did, and before we even get to the, because I wanted you ended up in L.A., I mean, you actually went to Howlin' Wolf's funeral. And you know, I don't think you knew that you went to Howlin' Wolf's funeral, but your band director told you to go give your respects. What was that like? It's fascinating to me that you got to go to such a funeral like that. And I'm sure it was, if he would have passed away in this day and age, it would have been way different than it did then in the 70s. It might have made sort of an impression on.
Yeah, my band director, shout out to Junior High School on the South Side. He came into school that day and looked over the middle and those of you curious, just up the street at our league funeral home, there's a man lying in state that you go pay your respects to. He didn't say who it was.
Mm-hmm.
He just talked, you know, we assumed because, you know, we're doing music that it had to be someone musical. So just a couple of guys, so we went after school and walked in the leak, and you know, it's a funeral home, so we go, there's people there, there's mourners and the whole thing, and we're, you know, I'm like, what, 16, 17 years old, walk up to the front, I acknowledge the, you know, the family, bereaved family in the front, and I go up to the casket and I look down in the casket, pay my respect, walk out, and I see the book and I leave. And so it was a couple of years later, because I guess I didn't have presence of mind to walk to Mr. Hunter, who the
who was that?
Who was that? But I just looked, but I remember the, and I got a card in the mail, and it's, oh man, if I had only kept this stuff. I mean, it was like, thank you for, you know, blah, 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 the family, Chester A. Burnett.
Yeah.
That was it. They didn't even put the Howling on. It was just Chester A. Burnett. And, you know, just it was a few years later that I was like, oh, wow, that.
That was how. That's,
yeah, I mean that's the giant. I mean, you know, outside of, you know, Muddy Waters, you know, in this town, it, I mean, that's, you don't know, bigger than that guy.
So, right.
So it was awesome. You know, it was a weird moment, but then later on, you know, and then, you know, coming full circle, you know, we'll talk, of course, I'm sure later, coming full circle back around, you know, it kind of makes sense that I was, you know, in his presence at that moment.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, so you must have known you wanted to be a professional musician or at least do something with music at that point, right? I mean, yeah. In your teens, in your high school. So, I mean, how did that continue? Did you start playing gigs around Chicago before you, I mean, headed out? I mean, were you studying with somebody? How did that whole thing happen?
Well, I was basically taught, well, I started piano at age five.
Oh, okay.
And that was because, Mont raised my two sisters, they're all older than me. I was the one that ended up with the piano lessons because Ramsey Lewis was being in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some reason or other, I remember it was Wading in the Water and Ramsey Lewis Trio. And for whatever reason, we had the piano in the house. And I think my sister Diane had gotten piano lessons, and she, you know, lost interest. And so the piano was just sitting there collecting dust, right?
Yeah.
And so, here this song comes on.
Yeah.
So I'm five year old little kid, starts to climb up on the piano bench and starts to try to bang what he hears, you know. And so my aunt Ruby, God bless her, she recognized that. Oh, well, heck, well, maybe we'll give him the lessons. And so that's how that started.
Wow.
And from there, my patience wore thin. I took piano lessons from a private teacher on my block, and then I also took lessons at Lion and Healy downtown.
Oh, yeah,
Chicago.
Sure.
And, you know, I took them for a few years, about up to age 10 or so, and I was like, okay, when do I learn how to play like Ramsey Lewis?
Right.
You know,
that was my problem. I play drums and I'm sitting there playing like these lame tunes. I'm like, I don't want to play these lame tunes, man. What is this?
Exactly.
Good.
Exactly.
I'm not alone.
I'm like, okay, when do I get this hip stuff?
Oh, right.
So I dropped out of that. And then about a year or so later, Jimi Hendrix came into view for me.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, man, that's what I want to do. That's hip. So I went to Aunt Ruby. I said, you know, can I have a guitar? She was like, yeah, no, we saw how the music lesson, the piano lessons went. We'll see about that. So that was a while. It was a while before I ended up getting my first guitar. The first guitar that I got was my brother Maurice had a Serial Overtone 6-string at his apartment.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And he wasn't playing, he fooled around with it. He, you know, actually, you know, family's musical, but nobody went into it but me professionally. Mm-hmm. But he had this thing at the house, and he's like, you know what, take it with you. You know, just, I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, take it. You know, it's just collecting dust. So I got it. Then my sister, Diane, I think it was Diane again, she got me the Superfly soundtrack album. At like 12. And so I'm sitting there on the bed, I got the little record player going, and then I'm trying to pick out the guitar parts on the record, but all I can hear is is Chicago's own, the late great Lucky Scott, playing boom 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 boom. I'm like, oh, this, okay, wait, this here, it changed my life. And so I instinctively, I guess, I took top two strings off the guitar, and that was my bass. That's how I taught myself how to play bass. And then I ended up getting a somewhat of a I call him my sensei, mentor, late great bassist, Chicago guy by the name of Thomas Palmer, nicknamed Tyaz. And he played with Ramsey Lewis. He played played with Morris Jennings.
Yep.
In with Ramsey Lewis's band and Herbie Hancock. A lot of different session stuff he did. So he was the one that turned me on to Jaco Pastorius and different things, and just handled myself professionally and in the studio and stuff. So when I got with Tyaz, he really made me laser focused on what I wanted to do. I kind of wanted to be a musician, especially when I got into high school and under George Hunter's wing. But then when I got with Tyaz, you know, sitting down with him, I was like, yeah, this is definitely where I want to go.
Yeah. Yeah. When you were in Chicago around that time, or when you were starting to learn after high school, before you went to LA, was the studio scene still happening here in Chicago? Cause I mean, it was still, you could still make a living recording, right? There's a lot of jingle work. There was a lot of things like that. A lot of recording still happening in Chicago at that point, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. There was still, Record Row was still here. It was, you know, it was going away, but it was still here. So I got to, you know, I got to record at Brunswick. I got to record at for Shy Sound Records, for Universal up in there. So yeah, those guys were still those session work. People like the late Danny Leek, who just passed away, God bless him.
Yeah.
He was one of the top rhythm guitar players at that time. Byron Gregory, also a great guitar player. All those guys, Morris Jennings, you know, all of those cats were just, they were going from session. They were doing like they were doing in LA. They were going session to session, you know, and that's what that was still going on at that time. So
I remember, it was great. I remember Mo Jennings telling me about that, because we talked before it came on, and he would let me sit in when I first came back from college, and he would tell me about the back when there was recording stuff happening in Chicago, and you know, God, he must have been on over 1,000 jingles and recordings, I'd imagine, over the years.
At least.
I mean,
least.
That's how much. That's how much was. Yeah. Oh man. Yeah. I know. And he would never look like he was paying any attention either. He'd just be like, oh yeah, whatever. And he was just laying it down. It was like, okay.
Yeah.
So how'd you? So you're playing around town. You're starting to play gigs too, right? Starting to play out and things like that. Mm-hmm. How did you end up deciding to go to LA? Were you playing with someone here and just said, you know what, I know enough people in LA, I should head to LA, because it seems like the scene is even more, you know, lucrative than being here.
Yeah, well, how all that happened, I got to back up just a little bit. The reason I started doing the gigs in town and the session work was because of George Hunter, my band director in high school. He was a woodwind player that played on a lot of records in town, and so he's the one that me in under his wing and showed me, you know, and introduced Tom 84 and to Carl Davis and Sonny Saunders and all of those guys that were doing the records. And he said, hey, this young kid, you know, he's good, he's playing, you know, he's playing pretty well. So they gave me the shot, and so I started working on records with Gene Chandler and Jerry Butler and Shirley Bassey and those people. So, you know, and so on the live shows, he had a band, a big band called George Hunter and the Moonlighters. And the reason they were called the Moonlighters was because they were teachers, doctors, and lawyers, but all very accomplished jazz musicians.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was a great, you know, tutorial, if you will, live tutorial. 16 years old playing bass with these.
Yeah.
These cats that are really doing so, you know, I got to see how men, real professionals, acted on the shows and the gigs and how things were, how they handled. So it was a great lesson.
That's the thing. I think a lot of students when they're in college and they're going to music school and they're doing all this stuff, get out, and you have to have those experiences, because you don't learn the stuff we're learning. You don't learn that in music school, man. You know, being on a bandstand with Moonlighters, right? All of these accomplished musicians and stuff. I mean, you know, these guys knew how to handle a gig, knew how to do stuff. So you're learning this at 16, 17, 18. I mean, you know, that's an education right there. You can't pay for that.
It is. It really is. So, yeah. So there, I got started getting work with, you know, some, you know, local acts and stuff outside of George Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one really break me, and give me an idea of where I wanted to go from there was the legendary Phil Upchurch. I got to work with Phil.
Oh yeah.
And he was that revelation for me because he, you know, was just so intense on the bandstand, very serious his music, a jokester, but very, very serious about his craft. And everyone around him felt that. And so, you know, so I'm like, oh, this cat means business. I gotta look down.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, we started working together for a couple of years. I recorded with him one album that did. And from him, Bobby Lyle, the great bass player, composer, was coming through Chicago to play. He was playing a gig at the Green Mill, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
And, you know, he needed a pickup band. And so he called Phil. I'm coming through. You know, who do I get? And he referred me to him. And so I get the phone call, you know, hey, Larry Campbell. I'm like, hey, this is Bobby. How are you? Yeah, okay. You know, the genie. Really? For real? It was him. And he said, listen, I'm coming through Chicago. I need a band. Can you put it together for me? And I said, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So we ended up trying to remember who played drums with him. Oh, wow. That's right. He already had the drummer. It was Michael Baker. Great Michael Baker.
Oh, yeah.
Played Houston for years.
Yep.
It was Michael Baker. It was myself on bass. Had... oh gosh, who else? Perry Hughes, I think from Detroit on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I hired James Perkins on sax. And I'm trying to remember. Yeah, there wasn't another keyboard player. So it was me, James.
Yeah.
And also Ernie Ames might have played drums too at one point when Michael wasn't able to. I think so.
Yeah.
But anyway, we did those and they went off so well that he hired us to tour.
Oh, wow.
The country with him. Yeah. So that first, you know, second foray, if you will, into touring the nation and internationally, because the first one was obviously with the Staple Singers. I did that for 5 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, but a long way around to get to the LA thing, I was playing with Bobby and Blake, and he invited his former boss, Anita Baker, to the concert.
Uh-huh.
She heard me play. She and her husband were there. They heard me play. I was introduced to them after the show. And I'll never forget, Jonathan Butler actually opened
the show. Oh, wow. I'm
working with later on past, but they were just the people. And at the end of the show, get her husband and my whoever needs player, you know, please think of me, you know, look me up.
Yeah.
And her husband, Walter, looked at the card. Like, he looked back at me. Oh, wow. Okay. Cool. We're actually getting rid of our bass player. So, I mean, you know, the timing couldn't have been
more
perfect. And so it was some time later. I was still living in Chicago. About 6 months later, I got a call from Sherwin Bash. At the time, her manager. Hey, you know, Anita has suggested you for her world tour, compositions world tour. Would you like to be a part of it? I'm like, yeah.
let me free up my schedule. Wow, man.
Yeah, you know, and so we did that. And then, you know, there's all these little threads. But anyway,
sure.
All of the guys in that group, one of the guys, the musical director for that group at that time, Chicago's own Ray Fuller, with the Weeper, guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Killer guys. That's my boy. That's my brother. But the other guys, I didn't know. I had heard of some of them, like Doc Gibbs on percussion and different people.
Mm-hmm.
Rayford Griffin on drums. But we, you know, we weren't friends. After we got through with that tour, those cats were like, man, you got to come out to L.A., man. Man, you'll work, da 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 da, blah blah blah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay. Well, I'm thinking about it. I'm still hesitant though. I'm like, oh, no, but okay. If you know, all right, thinking, you think I can make it? Okay. So I went back home and went back to Chicago and was sitting around, kind of twiddling my thumbs and you know, and I was looking, I was thinking my at my my then wife, and I was like, you know what? wow, what do you think? And, you know, she's like, well, let's, you know, let's try it. You can always come home.
Right. Right.
So, you know, we went out and, you know, kind of the rest is history. It all just kind of started to flow.
Yeah.
From there. And yeah.
Well, that's one of those things too. I mean, you're touring the world with Anita Baker, and then you come back to Chicago, and, you know, to have those experiences, and then you come back to Chicago. I mean, what are you going to do? Go play at a, I mean, what are you going to do? Go play at the Green. I love Dave Gemmelo. No offense. Go play at the Green Mill, or do you want to get on another tour? You want to do some more stuff?
And exactly.
Especially at that point, I think, I mean, until recently, I'm not sure. I think you needed to be on the West or the East Coast. And, you know, maybe 15 years ago, maybe is when things started changing because of the internet and because everybody knew everybody and you'd get pulled out on a tour living in Chicago. But I think back then you needed to go out on the coast, right? Because that's how you met people. And that's where all the work was kind of creating to go on those tours.
Right, right. Yeah, you were either on the West Coast, the East Coast, or down in Nashville trying to break into that.
Yeah.
That tight-knit little group, you know, which was, you know, as they say, pert near impossible, you know. So I had to go either west or east. And so I chose west and ended up, getting called back for Anita's second tour. Mm-hmm. I was out there about 6 months into my time being there. Got the call from George Duke, who was a friend of his, and, you know, that whole connection. And
yeah.
My first record that I played on out there was with George and the late new Chancellor, Paul Jackson Jr. on guitar, and myself on upright bass. And there was a Japanese project that he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you know, I did, you know, 6 or 7 solo albums with Jim, toured the world with him, you know, off and on for 20 years up until his.
So
from that tree. You know, as Wolf, not Howlin' Wolf, but as Willie Dixon would say, all of those, you know, just from that tree, just kind of, you know, all of that George Duke tree, it just, you know, it just blossomed with Michelle Pharrell from that, from Jonathan Butler, David Sanborn, Diane Reeves, Al Jarreau, all of these great people, Billy Cobham, of course, with George Duke, Billy Cobham thing. So many, many things came from that. Many experiences came from just being in that George Duke camp. And so I can't say enough about that guy. He was so so open and such a sweet, kind, no ego whatsoever. You would think with all of his accomplishments, his abilities on that instrument, that he would be, just the nicest cat, man. He loved pasta and he loved espresso, you know. So I love him to death. I miss him, man, so much.
Well, and also, I mean, to be, you know, you connected with these people because you connect with one person and then another person and then another person and then another person and then it grows out. And then, as you said, the George Duke tree, right? Because all those other people are around that. I mean,
right.
You know, and as you're playing and as you're learning music, I mean, what kept pushing you? Obviously, was it maybe because you had to learn the music for a specific tour, a specific gig, and then you went down other roads and you learned this style, that style, or what it was? Or were you just constantly consuming music and constantly consuming so that your playing kept getting better and better? Because, you know, I mean, you know, a lot of guys that'll go out on a tour and they're on a tour for 20 years and they know the tunes and it's no big deal. And, you know, fine, I can play the tunes. It's no big deal. There's no reason to continue to practice or try to get better or try to do any recording or anything else because I got this cushy gig. So what keeps you motivated creatively?
Great question. Yeah, I just kind of, I knew that the competition with, in LA, I knew it was, you know, I mean, I'm going up against, first of all, guys that are already well established. I'm going up. My competition is Nathan East and Neil Steubenhaus and Freddie Washington and people like that. So I'm like, you got to bring the A game out here. you got to bring the A game. You got to be up on your stuff. You got to leave the ego at the door. You got to really know, and you really have to hone your craft. It's not just enough to be a good or a great bass player. It's a whole encompassing thing. It's about personality. It's about timeliness. It's all those intangibles, being able to navigate different personalities and different styles of communication and all of that. It's really it's a balancing act that you have to learn to do in order to be at that level and to stay there consistently.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it was a thing that I just made up my mind, you know, this is what I got to do. If I'm going to be up against guys, I got to be as good or better at, than these guys are.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, God, I think I accomplished a little bit of that anyway.
So. I certainly think so. I want to remind everybody we're listening. I'm Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, ChicagoJazz.com, and Chicago Music Revealed, which is what you're listening to every day at 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. And we are talking with Bear Williams, who is what stories, and I'm so glad we got to connect with you because, I mean,
likewise.
You know, as I said at the outset, we could talk for 4 hours about your career. Before I get into you coming back to Chicago, I always am curious. I was talking to John Prime last week. And I was curious from his standpoint, because, you know, he played with Muddy. He played with all these different guys as sidemen. And then, of course, he started running his own group. But for you, you're getting these things and you're playing with, you know, world-renowned artists as well. What was the process that you went through? And I always like to talk about this because myself as a musician, I think an accomplished musician or even a beginning musician would find this fascinating. When you get the Anita Baker gig, let's say, you get the Anita gig. And you walk in and they're like, okay, what's the process that you have to go through to learn their repertoire and to be able to walk out on stage? Because, you know, maybe there was a rehearsal or two, but I can't imagine that you guys were sitting in a studio for, you know, 3 weeks learning all of her repertoire. So what was your process? How would you handle learning music for somebody who is so well known and they have their own sound and you have to, you know, accompany them? I mean, that's what's your process with that?
Well, for that one, interesting enough, yeah, I got the music in advance of a few weeks of the rehearsals, the production rehearsals, and started learning that. I mean, she had her, you know, what she wanted to do on the tour, so we knew that in advance. And so, you know, they got to L.A., excuse me, and then they put us up in the hotel. We rehearsed for 6 weeks before it's true.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So it was a, you know, cause there was production, there was lights and sound and we had tuxedos on and the whole, you know, it was a beautiful, there was tulle and all kinds of, you know, it was beautiful. So, you know, marble steps and the whole deal, you know, and so they had to, you know, work all that stuff out. So it was a definite big production, both the tours.
Yeah.
And, that being said, but you know, you come in somebody you want to do and being tried and recorded by Freddie Washington in the East.
Right.
Those are the two guys that I'm you know, I'm emulating, if you will.
Right, right.
So my process for that is I'm going to listen to everything that they've done and I'm going to key in on every nuance that they're doing. And if it sounds important to me, to the music, I'm going to repeat. I'm also going to not just mimic them, I'm going to bring myself into the music. So I'm going to try my best to take it to another level, to take it where they took it here. Now, live, it's up to me to take it.
Yeah, yeah.
Up a notch.
Exactly.
You know, so that's kind of the mindset going in. That's kind of always been my mindset with whatever group that I'm working with, to take what's given me, and honor the music, you know, honor the what's been laid down, but then also kind of elevate it. As if like a cooking word, you know, they say, yeah, I'd like to elevate that a little bit more, you know, elevate the hamburger to a new height, you know, but that's what you're doing.
You know,
you're elevating the music, taking what's there. Okay, I got this. Great. Perfect. Got this down. Now, how can I make this better?
Yep.
You know, how can I make this stuff really pop live? Because that's what it's all about. So that's been my mindset.
Yeah.
That's been it.
Because when you're doing those gigs, I mean, you're doing exactly what you said, and then you want to make sure you put your own voice in there in some aspect of it, right? And I always think that's the difficult part because unless you can find that fine line where you're really making it all sound exactly the way they want it to sound, and then you can add your little extra thing, which kicks it up a notch, as you said, and mm-hmm. that's your voice. I don't know how many people can actually do that successfully. Obviously, you can. That's why you keep getting calls, and that's why you continue to play like that. But there's that little fine line. I mean, it probably takes a little bit. You've got to be confident in what you're doing and never worry about what you're doing, because you know you should have the gig and play that gig, and then you can add your stuff in there. I think sometimes maybe people are just hanging on for dear life because they got the gig, and they're like, okay, I just don't want to screw anything up. You know, and that's usually the pure recipe for not having the gig anymore, probably.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true too. You know, it's funny. I was listening to, I think it was your interview with Chuck Webb.
Yeah. Yep.
Who was a buddy of mine, you know, talking about all those guys that were, at the audition for Meola, oh, yeah. And how they were, you know, everybody was shitting music and, you know, doing all this stuff and you know, how it all came down to, you know, his feel.
Yeah.
You know, we know you can get the notes, but how his feel was the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a big part of it. It's how you're feeling, you're making the music feel. So I agree 120% with Chuck. If it's not feeling good, you know, what's the, I mean, as Drew say, what's the never tears, it's got to be funky. So, it's got to feel good.
That's awesome.
If it doesn't, then you're missing that connection. You're missing that connection with your audience, you know, that you're so desperate trying to make and create. And it's a cool thing. And that's what we're all missing right now.
Yeah.
In this pandemic, is we're missing that give and take, that wonderful vibration is when great music meets a receptive audience. It's there's nothing like that.
No, you're right. And that's where a lot of live streams, you just can't, you can't recreate that. You just can't recreate that. So let's talk about how you came back to Chicago. And also, your name is Bear Williams, but it wasn't always Bear Williams. So I want to talk a little bit about how Larry became Bear Williams and how you ended up coming back to Chicago.
Yeah. So about 5 years ago, I was in a place where, okay, well, I was just going to be decided to come back. I was like, okay, I've kind of done everything that I wanted to do here, in LA.
Is it easy to get burned? Is it easy to get burned out in LA? I mean, is it just kind of like after a while, is it like, you know, all right, the traffic and all, it's just like, man, you know, I mean, let's go up to Chicago just for a change of pace. And it's just a different vibe.
Well, first of all, I do need to say I actually came back originally to marry my high school sweetheart.
Oh, okay.
Heidi, I love you. But anyway, that was the major motivation for moving back. My family was here. A lot of my family's here, both sides of the family. Them, you know, weddings and births and, you know, and funerals. So much being there. So I started to weigh reward versus what I was losing, and you know with the rekindling of my high school sweetheart, went to prom together and military ball, all that stuff, you know, and with the rekindling of that relationship, it was like, okay, do I, because we toyed with the idea of her moving there,
okay,
and but we were like, she'd have to give up so much. Because she is herself, in addition to doing my business management, she's also an accomplished opera singer herself. She's studying at Northeastern University. Mm-hmm. She works, you know, full time there as well as a office administrator for the College of Business and Management. She's busy. She's busy as a cat covering up, you know what, with one paw. But so that was my major motivation. And when I came back, I had started, before I left L.A., I had started some blues-based projects with some dear friends of mine. Ricky Zahardes on guitar, Herman Matthews on drums, Texas boy, North Texas boy as well, and Bill Steinway on keyboards. And so that music that he recorded a few years earlier became the catalyst for the reinvention of Kimpel into who I am now, which is Bear Williams. Now the name Bear is my is D's nickname. That's that's what that is. So, okay. You know, oh, you're my bear. So you know, that was cool, and it fits.
Sure, yeah, it fits.
And so, and I was like, you know, let me. I said, Larry Kimpel, I don't know if that does what it needs to do for a blues artist. I just don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. And so I said, Bear, that's that. And then in order to honor our mother, our mother's maiden name was Williams.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Bear Williams.
Yeah.
And so I started, you know, calling up a few friends and, you know, say, hey, what do you think about that name? Ba-da-da-da-da. People were like, I like it. I like that. Cool. Very cool. So it just kind of stuck. So 4 years later, you know, 4.5 years later, here we are. You know, Bear Williams was born. So, you know.
Cool. Good.
Going on, yeah.
And you've got, so you got two recordings out now under Bear Williams, right? And,
yes.
And it's underneath your own record label. You started a record label, GVR. What's GVR stand for?
That is God's Voice Records, actually. So it's God's Voice Records.
Yeah. So talk about, I mean, you know, you play all of this different music. Why did you come back to the blues? I mean, what was it that brought you back to the blues? Because, you know, somebody like you who's playing, I mean, George Duke, first of all, I mean, and everything else doesn't mean you mm-hmm. can't play that on your blues gigs, obviously. I mean, you know, you're coming back. Now you're playing blues. What brought you back to that style of music?
I think it was something that I was missing. It was just a piece of my story that I wanted to tell.
Mm-hmm.
The music was so prevalent when I was growing up here that it was just something that was in me. And I think it was just a natural transition to come back to the organicness. I mean, jazz is organic too.
Right.
You know, it moves and breathes and lives and changes and morphs and all that. You know, good jazz is supposed to do that.
Right.
So does blues. So does the blues genre. It should move and grow and evolve and change. And so I love that organicness about it. I love the simplicity of it. And I love the stories.
Mm-hmm.
Of it. I'm a huge country and western fan. You know, the story they tell. So the blues are very similar in those, you know, stories of triumph, tragedy, drink, art, whatever, life stories. So that was intriguing to me, and it kind of brought me back. I was like, okay, let me stand on this music, you know, again, while paying off to those that came before me, mm-hmm. but putting my own up on it. So.
Well, and looking over to the different videos and up on your website, which should mention, and that's BearWilliamsMusic.com, and that's where they pick up the two pieces and find out everything else you have going on when everybody has something going on, hopefully very soon.
Yes, exactly.
But you're at Buddy Guy's. I know you play at Rosa's, Buddy Guy's, a whole list of the blues places here in Chicago specifically mm-hmm. that I'm talking about. Yeah. But I mean, with Buddy Guy's on stage with you on some of those recordings there, and he's there, and there's the legend, right? I mean, he's one of the last living legends, that connection to the past. Have you known Buddy for a while? I mean, is that a connection that you had before you even went to before you left town, or is it a reconnection?
No, it's actually a connection.
Oh, good.
We didn't know of each other, you know, before. I mean, I knew of him, of course.
Sure.
But when I came back and started working with at his club, shout out to Mark Maddox and the whole gang, the Guy family. Gets a shot to get in there and become a staple,
mm-hmm.
at the club. That's when I met him, and just in awe of the guy. I mean, he's just everything that he's done. It's just, you know, when you walk upstairs to the dressing room in the club, you know, there's all this memorabilia all over the club, but upstairs in the dressing room area and the offices, there's all these things on the walls and just all this history, all this blues history. It's like, wow, this cat is just amazing. It's an amazing body of work, and so you feel honored to stand on that stage. It's I'm sure it's likened to you know, people going to perform at the Apollo Theater mm-hmm. in New York. It's, you know, it's, for me, it has that same kind of a hallowed respect. You know, you have to have that respect for that stage, as well as shout out to Tony Manguillo over at Rosa's and Johnny over Johnny's Blitz in yep. Westmont. They're all doing the same thing. They're all, you know, paying homage to that past, present, you know, but there's an honor there mm-hmm. In that music and that blue, the blues family. And yeah, but I did not know Buddy, you know, before I came back. So it's, you know, it's great to have him, you know, in my life, you know?
Oh yeah. Well, and you know, and just before we wrap it up, but since we're talking about Buddy, and I just can relate back to any of the blues artists, any of the legendary blues artists that you know, but also go to the jazz, go to the R&B, go to any of them, you know, they don't all like one style of music, and they all, right. most of them all can play a lot of other styles of music. I know Buddy in particular, you know, I know he's a Wes Montgomery and everybody else. When you start talking to him about stuff, he can talk to you about that stuff for 3 hours without even thinking sure. about it. So I think that's one of the things that people don't realize, and probably one of the things you bring to the table, because you know you're playing blues, but I mean it's Bear Williams blues, which is a combination of, like you said, country mixed in with some funk, mixed in with some R&B, mixed in with blues tradition. I mean and these albums that you have, talk a little about the two recordings you have. I mean, did you write most of the music on there? How did the inspiration come to start recording this stuff in that genre?
Very quickly to say that, shout out also to the Mighty Quinn over at buddyguyradio.com.
There you go.
That's my man. He's been really instrumental in bringing this music, you know, my music to the forefront. So I love you. I love you. Pat Quinn, by the way.
By the way,
Sir Henry of WVON.
Yep.
Sir Henry Cheatham.
Yep.
First guy that ever played a Bear Williams song on any radio. Thank you so much, Henry. Love it. And then also Katie Lowe over at Rhythm and Flow.
Yeah.
But anyway, the songs. Yes, I did do all of the lyrics, the melody, you know, some of the arrangement, along with my guys, you know, Ricky and Herman and then Bill. But the most of the ideas came from me. You know, we brought them in and we all flushed them out, and you know, and that's, and what we have is the result of the record, you know. Yeah. Also shout out to my live band here in Chicago, you know, Bill Bricky and Alton Smith and Chris Winters and my wife Dee, she sings with me, as well as my bonus daughter Dana and her fiance Lucas, I can say that now, and we also had the great Clyde Davis on the drums, as well as Kwame Steve Cobb and different other drummers. So you know, shout out to those guys. We couldn't do it without you guys. We love
no.
them, so
well,
but getting back to the concept of those records.
Yeah,
again, we wanted to do the blues, but we wanted again. Elevated, mm-hmm. not taking away from what the blues already is, because it doesn't need any. It doesn't need any elevation. It is what it is. But our concept or our thought was to. What if we fused some elements together? You know, we're not the first to do that. I mean, people have been doing that a while, but you know, put our spin on it. You know, my spin on it, and that's where the music came from. So it's. It does have the song Waters of Love. It does have a definite country blues feel to it. You know, feels like a country and western song. You know, No Love on the Waters of Love album. It, you know, it has a sort of a traditional blues thing to it, but kind of takes a turn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
takes a kind of a rock edge turn to it. So you know, there's a few different things. We try to have fun with it. You know,
but those are all those are all musical influences that make up Bear Williams, and that makes sense, mm-hmm. right? So that's mm-hmm. how it comes out. You're telling your story in the midst of telling all these other stories, and I think that's
right.
that's that one little point that a lot of musicians, it just takes years to get to that point mm-hmm. where you can actually. Play your own music and feel like this is your own voice, and listening to this stuff and watching those videos and stuff, I can tell this is Bear Williams. It's great.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much, Mike. Appreciate
yeah.
it.
Well, Bear, it's been great having you on the show. And by the way, you can't see the comments, but I will tell you this. Pat Quinn, kudos to my dear friend Bear Williams. So he commented already.
Awesome. Very cool.
There you go. Love so we're gonna tell everybody go over to BearWilliamsMusic.com. And Bear, it's been a pleasure talking with you. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again, hopefully in person, live somewhere.
Absolutely, Mike.
You know, this has been great. Keep me posted on everything you have happening, and hopefully we will see you out performing live somewhere in a club sooner rather than later. Fingers crossed.
You too, my friend. Keep us moving.
That's right. All right, Bear, a good one.
Yeah, take care.
Bear Williams, wow. I'm telling you, man, we could have talked probably for another 2 hours. I didn't even go down the road to start talking about Mavis Staples and the Staples Singers. I mean, he toured with them for 5 years. He just kind of mentioned it. I mean, you know, but that's because he's played with all these people. It's incredible. So I'm so happy we got to hook up with him. That's the beauty of this show, Chicago Music Revealed. I get to talk to all these different incredible musicians from Chicago, New York, L.A., across the world, across the entire world, actually. I had Guai on, 3 weeks ago from Brazil. So, I mean, we're all connecting. So if you have somebody that maybe I should touch base with, maybe we should get on the schedule, maybe we should talk with, or if you are that person, hit us up, leave us a comment, leave us a message. But I'm going to encourage everybody, go over to BearWilliamsMusic.com. Check it out. He's got both releases up there. They're under GVR Records. You will not be disappointed. And also, if you get a chance, do a YouTube search for Bear Williams or Larry Kimball and Kim Pell. K-I-M-P-E-L. I'm so used to calling him Bear. Sorry. So do a search for that, and you're going to find some incredible stuff on YouTube too, man. He is killing it, period. End of story. Okay. So tomorrow, we are going to have a great show tomorrow. We got J.D. Walter on tomorrow. We're going to be talking about all of his brand new recording that's coming out. Actually, it just came out, so we're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about Wayne Powers and performing live with the Shout Section Big Band on Thursday. And then Petra Van Nous will be on Friday. So that's the lineup for the rest of this week. 6 p.m. right here on Chicago Music Revealed. Every day, Monday through Friday. And as I always say, if you like what you're hearing, please like it. Please share it. Tell your family, tell your neighbors, call the grandkids every single day here, Monday through Friday, 6 p.m., Chicago Music Revealed. Thank you for watching. Hopefully, see you tomorrow, or hopefully, you will see me tomorrow.